Blog Talk Radio.
And we are live, although it seems to be on a minute delay, strangely enough. To think we haven't had these problems for about 6 months, or since pretty much Seth and Sean really actually got started. Hi, everybody. Seth Kamens. This is episode probably somewhere around 35 or so, 32. I probably should start counting. In our last one on Wednesdays. Welcome to Seth and Sean. I was supposed to run solo today or bring in a guest host, but in a Willis Reed-esque performance, I would like to add the slightly drugged up, yet still more coherent than 98% of the sports fans, Mr. Sean Palmer, to our show. Sean, are you with us?
Daniel LaRusso's gonna fight. Daniel LaRusso's gonna fight.
You do realize that half of our listeners don't know who Daniel LaRusso is, right?
That's right. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me put it this way. Jaden Smith is gonna fight. Jaden Smith. That's right. That was for those that don't know, that's a reference to the Karate Kid, Ralph Macchio and Pat Morita. I believe that's 1985.
Something along those lines.
For those that were born after, that was my first crush that was on Elizabeth Shue, which I still hold today. Even at 46, she's looking mighty fine. And this is Sean Palmer. Thanks again to Seth for that wonderful gimpy introduction. I am the gimp today, and my knee is heavily swollen, but making a Willis Reed comeback, here we go, without the hip injury. And we got a lot to talk about today. We got the NHL, major, major games being played in the last couple of days. We got game five tonight with the Rangers and the Devils, the Kings in overtime last night, absolutely taking the Western Conference by storm with only three losses, I believe, in all the series going into the Stanley Cup Finals against what will be a tired New York or New Jersey team. The NBA NBA quarterfinals are going on right now.
That's true.
It's the quarters.
You're right. You are correct.
It's the quarters. So we got the NBA quarterfinals or the conference semifinals. I believe that's where my esteemed co-host was going. We have a couple of guests on the show tonight. The illustrious Randy Zelia, our resident NBA Quasimodo expert. And we're going to be talking a little French Open with a guy that I've never heard of. So I'll let Seth talk a little bit about that.
Actually, you've dealt Ryan Krinigan, he was our tennis analyst and still actually one of the best writers on the site. He's moved more to a management level, but still an expert in all capacities of tennis. He's actually co-hosted the show with him before you came aboard. So he's going to be joining us at 6:35. We got Randy at 6:15. We're in the grade eight of the NBA. You were a little bit off. Vancouver, St. Louis, and Phoenix, the 1, 2, and 3 seeds combined to win two games, not three. Vancouver lost 4-1, St. Louis got swept, and Phoenix lost 4-1. To the eighth seed. So if anyone can figure that one out, go right ahead.
Well, remember, that I think we talked about this last week or a couple of weeks ago. This is far from a, quote, eighth seed. I mean, this team was sent for nothing in the bottom of the standings before Daryl Sutter came along and righted the ship. And they've been playing like a number one seed ever since then. But we do have some breaking news for tonight's game in the NBA. And we'll go to the NBA first, and we'll go back to the NHL. Well, actually, we're going to talk with the NBA with Randy Zelia, so let's continue with the NHL. Randy will be joining us at 7:15, Seth?
I think so, if his schedule can afford us such time.
Agreed. Our question of the day, or question of the week, which we got out really late due to my Percocet little habit
I think we should hold off on that one until next week.
Okay, well, then we'll preview it tonight. We'll ask our two guests tonight, and we'll continue this on until next week. It will be, what is the injury that you remember the most in sports? And, for instance, Dave Dravecki's arm when he had cancer and he broke it on a pitch. Or Napoleon McCallum, we all know what that was, the hyperextension of his leg and blown out the kneecap. Or Joe Theismann, Theismann, against Lawrence Miller, and that's, I said Joe.
You said Gerald.
Okay.
Is that Joe's brother?
Gerald, please. It may be, or son. But that is in memoriam of my knee, since
Fair
the
enough.
Gimp is now back. But so we're going to talk a little bit about that. But going back to the hockey.
Well, we should say if anyone wants to call in with questions or wants to talk about the injury or anything else, number 760-283-0846.
Absolutely.
So go back to the NHL. Yes, we have Game 5, Rangers-Devils tonight. It has been a frenzied city, New York, I think, is safe to say. I think the Rangers have had the better goalie but the worst team in these four games. I think the Devils have been the better team. But that being said, we are tied 2-2, and the Rangers have home field advantage, whatever you want to call it.
Home ice. They play on the ice.
I forgot. It's not street hockey. I forget that from time to time. It should be interesting. I mean, it's really a toss-up. When Marty Brodeur is the worst remaining goalie in the playoffs, and he is, as at age 49, 52, 56, whatever he is, he's been very good. He obviously made the save of a lifetime in a loss on Saturday. I don't know what they're calling it. His leg over his head, gymnast balance beam kind of stop. But they dominated game four. They very well could have won. They could have won all four games. And now, the Rangers are 2-2. The Rangers, I believe, have to win this game because I do not think they will win down 3-2 in New Jersey. There's no Mark Messier to make that guarantee that game. So I think this is a must-win for the Rangers.
I'd agree with you. I mean, the Rangers have been playing well on the power play. When they're 5-on-5, this team is not the same, no doubt whatsoever. But Henrik Lundqvist has stood on his head, aside from the one Marty Brodeur save. But Henrik Lundqvist has stolen the series so far for the Rangers. If the Rangers are going to go anywhere, King Henrik has to be that guy. Now, what's interesting is my brother, Mitch Palmer, who is an avid hockey fan, and I had this conversation. I know, Seth, you and I had this conversation a little while back. He is totally on board with the Devils winning this series because of Marty Brodeur. And he thinks that if he had one game to play in the NHL for any amount of money, he would put Marty Brodeur in as his goal stop. And I brought in Patrick Roth, who to me is the best goalie I've ever seen, along with Marty Brodeur. Marty Brodeur is a better facsimile to me of a Tommy John. I think he is in some ways a compiler. I think the fact that he has played both as a teenager and as a 40-year-old means that he's been around for a long time, and he's been great. I mean, no question about it. Obviously, he's better than Tommy John, but I think the fact that he's played so long has added to those records. But he is one incredible goalie, and if I'm going to put my money on a guy, I'm going to put it on Marty Brodeur tonight.
Well, I agree to a point. The problem with him being a compiler, as you said, as great a goalie as he is, and to me, Marty Brodeur is the second greatest goalie I've ever seen, career-wise. However, for a single game, there is one goalie who I would take over him. There's two goalies I would take over him that I have seen, potentially three. Number one would be Patrick Roy, or two. Number two would be Patrick Roy. But if I take one guy in his prime that I've seen, so I'm not going to go into the Glenn Halls or the Terry Sawchucks or the Ken Drydens. Yes, I just pulled those names up. So for anyone who doesn't think I have any hockey knowledge, badow. But
I don't. That was pretty impressive for you.
Go watch Thump the Schwab with me and check out my true hockey knowledge. But if I would choose one goalie for one game in his prime, it would have been Dominik Hasek in 98-99, who single-handedly carried a mediocre Buffalo team to an NHL Finals one year. And they probably should have gone to a game. And if you remember, they went to six games against a stacked Dallas team in 99 and lost on a disputed, to say the least, goal by Brett Hull.
Was he in the crease? Are you sure he was in the crease?
Oh, God, yes, he was in the crease. And what was so funny was I had friends who were from Buffalo who were at the game. The late, unfortunately, Eric Sellers, and I remember talking with him about it. And what he said it was so funny was no one realized at the stadium or at the arena that he was in the crease. So they all just accepted it as is. And then they get home and they saw this, and there's just an additional, like, Buffalo, because Buffalo sports hasn't suffered enough over the last, in the decade prior to that, with four AFC championships and Super Bowl losses. Now they're a town that could truly use a championship, and that was their best chance, because although they were not a great team, they did have a great defense. The thing with Marty Brodeur, which I question up to a point, is, remember, in his prime, they were playing that trap defense led by two Hall of Famers in Scott Stevens and Scott Niedermeyer, and a constant all-star in Brian Rafalski. Two very, very solid defensemen in Ken Danico and Colin White. So you were looking, I mean, this was a stacked defense and a system that played to his strength. So I don't know. So the shots that he was receiving were often limited. So as great as Marty was, and believe me, I don't think calling someone the third best goalie I've ever seen over 25 years of watching hockey is a particular insult. I just don't know if I would have him above Waugh or above Hasek at their best. But he is the best stick handler I've ever seen.
I agree with you in the fact that Hasek played fantastic in those years in Buffalo. And in his prime, you may be right for one game. I may have to agree with you. I know that's hard for me to say, but I may have to agree with you on that one point. However,
you're
once
on drugs,
Hasek
okay.
went... Yeah, I know. The drugs are making me say things I probably shouldn't be. But when you go past that and you go to, say, his time with the Red Wings, I mean, his time with the Red Wings, he had as much, if not more, firepower in front of him than Brodeur did with the Devils. I mean, you had possibly the best defenseman of all time with Nicholas Lindstrom. You had Steve Yzerman in front of you, Sergei Fedorov. I mean, talk about a stacked team. Brett Hull then became his teammate after he was the guy in the crease for those Buffalo fans that are still wiping their tears. And, I mean, that was an unbelievable team, possibly one of the best teams of all time, that Detroit team. So, I think tonight will be an interesting game. I think that you're going to see a lot of checking, a lot of heart. I mean, Mike Rupp, what he did in game four, going after Brodeur, was both interesting and moronic all at the same time. Interesting in the fact that Rupp was Brodeur's teammate for 5 years and knew exactly what he was doing going after Marty. And you could see that the minute that you don't touch the goalie. You just don't, because the minute you touch the goalie, you incite the entire team, and that's exactly what happened. And the Devils were definitely, they were stringing up before that. What was interesting was that the coaches went at it in the middle of the game, and they obviously were not asking for each other's phone numbers. It was just a very interesting back and forth between the two of them, and if you looked at if you saw the press conference, neither one of them was talking about it.
John Tortorella doesn't talk about anything in the press conferences. That's kind of a problem.
Sure. I was a little disappointed that Pierre Maguire turned off his microphone during that conversation, because that would have been YouTube central.
Well, Randy should be joining us shortly, so we'll start hitting on the NBA a little bit. I guess the main, starting with the East, where we had Miami really looking to take control of the series last night and out-toughening an Indiana team that really fell apart once Danny Granger got hurt. That being said, there was some really dirty play, a borderline dirty foul by Tyler Hansbrough, but two brutal plays, one by Udonis Haslem, which he did not
Who's
receive.
Been suspended.
He has been suspended for game six, and one,
yeah.
and one by Dexter Pittman on Lance Stephenson, which was just stupid.
Who's also
I guess
been suspended for game six.
Right, and game seven, and he's actually been suspended for three games. Now,
yeah.
That's not much what the problem may be is, okay, we now have – so what are we looking at? They're not exactly deep up front to begin with. And this suddenly makes, Miami being extremely hot with Wade and LeBron combining for 128 points in the last two games. But they have no, they're going to have no tough presence up front. And this may cause a problem going into game six. And in the, you know, this is the game you really kind of want to put Indiana away in this game. They're reeling a bit. GM Larry Bird called them soft, which certainly didn't help. Danny Granger is is not going to be, even if he comes back to play, will not be at his best. So what exactly are you looking at? This is the game for you to win, and now you're looking, you're missing your starting power forward on a team that barely has a front court presence to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, in this game, you're gonna see if Roy Hibbert can take advantage, because that's what it's going to come down to. I mean, the only guy that's up front for Miami, is from what I recall on the roster, is going to be Joel Anthony. We may see a Juwan Howard sighting where – I don't think he's played more than like 10 minutes all game, all year.
Well, there's one more name that will bring back fond memories to our New York sports fans. What if Miami activates Eddie Curry?
I'd love it. I'd love to see him try and run down the court at least more than four times. It would be interesting to see him without a hamburger. it's just going to be interesting because Miami has no depth. I mean, absolutely no depth. I'm looking up their roster right now just to see where they go from here, because I'm having a hard time seeing Bosch is out, Pittman's out, Haslam's out. Their roster is just depleted. Joel Anthony, so their starting power forward may be LeBron James, because they don't have another one unless they're starting Joel Anthony and Ronnie Turia both in the same lineup, which to me would be extremely exciting, seeing a 6'10 guy and a 6'9 guy being your starting center and power forward. But this is the problem when you build around three stars. I mean, the Knicks learned it when they had Jeremy Lin and Shumpert, Iman Shumpert, I almost said Preston Shumpert. I apologize, sir, if you're coming back into me. Iman Shumpert go down. You have a lack of depth. I mean, their starting five, the way I see it, is Mario Chalmers is going to start at the point. Wade's going to start at the two. The three will probably be Shane Battier. The four is going to be LeBron James, and the five will be Joel Anthony. That's not even a playoff team. I mean, maybe Mike Miller starts at the two, and you move guys around, and Wade plays a little three, or Miller plays a little three, but, I mean, that's not a playoff team, let alone a championship team.
No, it's a playoff team. It's not a championship. Any team with Wade and James is a playoff team. You could take you with your gimpy leg, me, and whoever the guy is who's threatening me via text, and I don't really understand why that is. Yeah, I'm being threatened via text. Apparently I have I just found this out, which is kind of interesting. You could take the three of us and add them to LeBron James and Dwayne Wade. We'd still make the playoffs. I would just have to play
especially
the five.
Maybe in the East, but definitely not in the West.
That is true.
But we don't know where
Randy is, and to be honest, we can continue to talk this without him. The other one in the East is Boston and Philly, which has been really a very bleh series in my mind. Philly, as I've stated, I find extremely lucky to be this far. They're a nice defensive team. They're a player or two away from being serious contenders.
Well, let's also remember that Mr. Kamens has picked the Celtics go all the way. So a blast series would turn into a monstrosity if Philly pulled this out.
No, I don't think a monstrosity would be the correct word. Coming from someone who took Missouri to win the national championship and Memphis to make the NBA finals, my picks are a bit dubious at that. So, I think Boston wins, and I think Boston will give Miami. If it's Miami, I think it's a good match. I think in a lot of ways, Miami is a better matchup for Boston than Indiana is. Obviously, Indiana is very powerful, is deep in their front. They have a better front court with Granger and West and Hibbert and Hansborough. And so the Boston really doesn't have it. They have Kevin Garnett, and although Brandon Bass was sensational in game five, they're not exactly a front court powerhouse. That being said, Avery Bradley is out for tonight, and Ray Allen has been hurt. Paul Pierce hasn't been at 100%, but they have the best probably three players in this series in Garnett, Pierce, and Rondo. And they will win, and I still think they're going to go to the finals.
Are you declaring a win tonight?
For Boston? Yeah. I'm not guaranteeing it.
I think you can only guarantee the win if you're actually on the team.
Yeah. So I think declaring
a win is as good as you can get if you're a fan.
Well, it's kind of hard for me to say I'm a Boston fan, but we do what we do. When I was growing up, I was a Lakers, you rooted for the Lakers or the Celtics, and the Lakers were a lot more fun to watch with Magic and Michael Cooper and James Worthy and the captain. Yes, we finally figured out who the captain was, Kareem. And, versus Bird, the great front court of Bird, McHale, and Parrish, and you rooted for either Boston or the Lakers, and I rooted for the Lakers. And now it's ironic because I've gotten into my 30s, I immensely enjoy watching Ray Allen and Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett. And the Lakers, who were eliminated in pretty embarrassing fashion a couple nights ago, are a team I don't particularly enjoy watching, except for Steve Blake, because, well, he's a Terp. Kobe tried to score 300 points, made 41 points, but on 34 shots. Andrew Bynum barely seems interested in playing for the Lakers going forward. Pau Gasol has apparently worn out his welcome. This is not a team that's a player or two away from a champion. That's a player away from a championship right now.
I agree with you. I mean, Bynum has become the guy that, believe it or not, the Jim Buss? Yeah, Jim Buss thought he was. I mean, the question is at this point, do they go out and if the Magic are in the mood to trade for Bynum and they will offer Howard, I mean, that's the other news that's happening in the NBA this week is that you knew it was going to happen, but Stan Van Gundy and Otis Smith are both out in Orlando. So we got a new package of people coming into Orlando and say, Jim Buss picks up the phone and says, hey, we'll give you Dwight Howard, you give us Andrew Bynum. Is that even worth it for the Lakers right now?
I don't know. The problem is this.
We've had this discussion for a couple of teams, and we can go through them. But with the draft coming up in a couple of weeks, it'll be even more interesting. Actually, it's at the end of the month. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted.
That's okay. The Lakers have to make a decision whether they can build around Bynum. And that's not an easy decision to make. As talented as he is moody. He is immature. And he doesn't seem to handle criticism very well. And playing in a city like Los Angeles, assuming next year that Gasol is gone, and Kobe can only play another 11 years, so at some point it's going to be his team. And if I'm going to give somebody $100 million, which is what he's going to request, he's going to ask for $90 million, $95 million over five, well, I got to be sure that I can trust this guy as my number one. And I don't know if the Lakers do. So that's the decision. I mean, Dwight Howard is 28 years old. He has a bad back, but for the most part is in the prime of his career. And a discussion that we've had previously, I don't believe Dwight Howard is the number one offensive threat on a championship team. So I don't really know what you do, to be honest. The only center who can be a number one scoring threat on a championship team potentially could be Andrew Bynum.
Yeah, we've had this discussion before, and whether Bynum could be a number one or not. And this even goes back to the Nets. And Seth and I percolated a couple of days ago about a discussion of how much the Nets would want Dwight Howard this offseason and what they would have to give up for him. And imagine that they get the number one pick in the draft and it's Anthony Davis. Is Anthony Davis worth, or is Dwight Howard worth Anthony Davis at this point? I mean, Dwight Howard is a talent. There's no doubt about it. And I don't know about anybody else, but if it's not the Stan Van Gundy saga that's in Orlando, I think Dwight Howard plays the rest of the last year. I mean, I don't think I'm not a medical doctor, although I played one on TV, and I have yet to see his medical records, but I got to think the guy plays through some pain and continues, and he saw the light at the end of the tunnel and said, you know what, I'm not going to do it. I'm gonna hold all the cards in this battle, and I'm going to make sure that the coach isn't back next year. Now, the question is Dwight Howard back next year? And where does he go? I mean, we've talked about all the logical places, but are there some illogical places that he goes as well? I mean, Boston would certainly be a illogical place, but would that make sense?
Actually, not particularly, because maybe after next year if he is a free agent, but what do you think Boston has to offer Orlando?
Well, they have Rondo to offer. I'm not saying that they do it, but Ainge has offered Rondo every single chance they've gotten. I mean, if they don't win this year, you can't. I mean, the problem that I have with building around Rondo, because that's basically what you're going to be doing, is Pierce has two more years on his contract at about $16 million. This is Garnett's last year on the contract, Allen's last year on the contract. Who are you building around? If you build around Rondo, you better get another shooter, because Rondo is possibly the best passer in the NBA right now as far as I'm concerned. And we watched some of the passes over the playoffs, and I've been astounded by how good a passer he is. But at the end of the day, he's still what Jason Kidd was early on in his career, in the fact that I'd give him any shot outside of 10 feet to shoot. I don't know about you. He does not impress me with his shooting whatsoever.
Well, it's not a question, does he impress you as a shooter? It's more along the lines of, is he scare you? I mean, compared to his passing, what's his weakest point? And obviously, his shooting is nothing spectacular, never has been. His passing, dribbling, and defense is among the top one or two in the league. If he could shoot, he could very well be the best point guard in the league. Luckily for defenses, he can't. And I agree, it's kind of scary to build a team around someone who can't score. But, again, we'll see what happens going forward. We should probably talk a little bit about the West. We have San Antonio in Oklahoma City. San Antonio has won 18 games in a row, 29 out of 30, I believe. Do you think Oklahoma City is going to beat them?
Yeah, I mean, San Antonio has been unbelievable, but I still pick Oklahoma City. I mean, I still think that they have what ails San Antonio in a series in which they can run. I think that you're going to see Oklahoma City run away from San Antonio. You're going to see the legs catch up to San Antonio. But they've had an amazing run so far. I mean, the last time that they lost a game, I believe there were like five players hitting 400 because it was like the first week of the baseball season.
Baseball season started?
It did. Unlike Seth, there are people that do follow baseball before August.
To be fair, in 2 weeks, when I am on a well-deserved vacation, and you can go.
Who said it was well-deserved? Wait. Who said it was well-deserved?
Said the man who I did, actually. So it doesn't really matter.
Okay, fair enough.
I will be on the West Coast for a wedding and for some whitewater rafting, and I will be taking the week off so you can talk all the baseball you like. And then when we come back, the NBA finals, Major League, NHL finals will be in high gear or just about at the end, and, it'll be time to start talking NBA draft and some baseball and some Olympics and some Euro soccer, because I know how excited you are about that. We're not... The idea of watching baseball in May is not that, it's just not that exciting to me. What can I tell you?
I am actually a little bit excited for Euro soccer now that I understand what it's about, and I can make my claim a little bit more that goals against should never count, or goals for should never count.
Well, in my closing, I'll discuss the Champions League, because I didn't want to, I figured 15 minutes last week of soccer was sufficient to really put any more time into it this week.
I would be more than happy to hold the torch. And we'll even talk a little Wimbledon when you get back, because I believe Wimbledon will be coming up, and the U.S. Open for golf.
is the week that you come back. So we should have a lot going on in the summer months. It looks like Randy has ditched us because he had too many good things going on his plate. So I guess we'll have to talk. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what can you do? So
our resident expert is not here. So we'll talk a little bit.
Is he a resident expert? See, Ryan Brennigan is a resident tennis expert. Keegan Reed, because we can't go one show without saying Keegan Reed, is our resident hockey expert.
And congratulations again to Mr. Reed on his nuptials.
Okay, we've given him enough credit over the last couple of weeks. Although we probably will, maybe we may try and have him on before the final, either before or during the finals. I actually like San Antonio to beat Oklahoma City. The one thing that scares me about Oklahoma City is, yes, Oklahoma City can outrun pretty much the Jamaican Olympic team.
And the bobsled team.
They can, but the Jamaicans, they're pushing a bobsled. How fast can you really run?
True,
just
fair enough. Moving on.
In a half-court game, yes, Kevin Durant, obviously you have the three guys who can create their own shot. But I don't like them. I don't know posting up. They have no post-up offense. Their post-up defense is solid. But I think we're looking at a team. I think they're a year away. I think this is San Antonio's last run. I think they're deep. Because they're so deep, they're not going to get tired. Tim Duncan playing 25 minutes has been sensational. Tony Parker's been a borderline championship MVP candidate if it wasn't for the great year that LeBron and Durant had. I like San Antonio in a great seven-game series. And I believe we have Mr.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I believe we have Mr. Krinigan on with us. Ryan?
Hello?
Hey, Ryan, how you doing? On with Seth and Sean. What's going on?
How's it going? Not bad.
Pretty well. We were talking a little bit of basketball before you came on. Any thoughts on the San Antonio Oklahoma City series coming up? I know that's not hold on.
I know I'm looking forward to it for sure. It'll be really, I think, the best series of the whole playoffs probably, unless the Heat pull off a miraculous kind of run late through the finals. I mean, even if they make the finals, I don't think it'll be too competitive of a series because I would expect the winner of the West to win the whole thing. I like San Antonio just because they seem to be a more complete team, but it should be offensive fireworks for sure.
It should be fun.
And now for the reason that you're on.
We haven't talked tennis for a while because, to be honest, it's been a strange year in tennis. Last year you had the great Djokovic run, and especially in the men's game, it's been pretty prevalent. He was so prevalent, not only in the tennis world, but in the sports world. And this year, not that he's taken a step back, but tennis as a whole seems to have taken a step back, except from some controversy with Rafael Nadal, which sounds kind of strange because he's one of the least controversial people you would ever assume would be. So what is the year? Before we even get to the French Open, what's been your thoughts on the men's game so far this year?
Well, like you said, I mean, Djokovic, he's still number one, but it's not quite the clear-cut number one that he was last year because he hadn't, at this point, lost a match. He did still win the Australian Open in a too-long final. It went about 6 hours against Nadal. So some people thought, is that Nadal closing the gap? Because that has become kind of the main rivalry with Federer on the outside looking in. But, of course, Nadal's recently reasserted himself on clay. Everything's back to normal. Federer has actually played had his best first 5 months of a season in years. Has already won, I believe, four titles this year. Won the crazy blue clay Madrid tournament. Played well in Rome. But it's kind of where we were last year in that going to the French Open, it's kind of a race between Djokovic and Nadal to see who's going to take it home.
Last year there was some hope with the Americans. Marty Fish was, although he came on late, came on more, not really in the clay court. John Isner had actually had a couple nice wins on clay. That being said, there is really very little reason. There doesn't seem to be much reason for hope with the American men. Donald Young hasn't progressed off of his solid run in Flushing Meadows. Ryan Harrison just kind of seems to be a journeyman. Are we looking at anything going forward?
Well, in the short term, I think it's safe to say that unless you're from Spain or Serbia or Switzerland, you're probably not going to win a slam. It's not just the Americans that are struggling. Everyone right now in this crazy era with three totally dominant, you know, Grand Slam champions, it's tough to find room for another big player. But John Isner's had a decent year. He made the finals of Indian Wells. He got a win over Federer on clay in Switzerland. But once they've transferred over to the European clay court circuit, his results haven't really lined up too well. And, you know, his serve is always going to keep him in matches. And he played Nadal to five sets in the first round last year. But there's nothing really to indicate that he's going to be a serious threat to knock out one of the top guys, I think, in Paris. After that, yeah, there is a serious drop-off. Ryan Harrison is promising, but it's going to be a while before he's any good on clay. Marty Fish is withdrawn. Andy Roddick has never been good on clay. And then Donald Young is just desperate to win points these days. I think he's 2-11 on the year. So,
Let's go a little bit off the beaten path, and I understand that the French Open is coming up, and I hope we get you on a little bit before Wimbledon and the Olympics as well, but we were talking about Americans. Is there any, I mean, tennis is a big part of the Olympic Games coming up in London. Should we be looking at, I understand that it's going to be played on a different surface, but for the Americans that are going to be playing in the Olympics, should we be looking for anybody specifically at the French that we will be seeing in London?
Well, as far as contenders to win gold medals, I would say Serena Williams. I know that's not a man, but she would definitely be the American's best shot at a gold medal. But as far as competing on grass, you know, Andy Roddick has always had good results on grass, a handful of Wimbledon finals, but he's not quite the player he once was. He really just grinds from the baseline, and on Wimbledon's courts, which will probably be even faster when it comes to the Olympics because they've already been worn over from the 2 weeks of Wimbledon play, you know, his lack of aggression is going to come back to bite him. And it's going to be a tough, any big tournament really, in general, you have to look at the top three and maybe Murray as the main contenders. Otherwise, it's really tough, you know. I think, you know, there's a strong core of Americans. Marty Fish was recently in the top 10, Isner, but, you know. That being said, Nicolas Massu of Chile won in 2004, and that was about the only thing he ever did in tennis, so you never know what can happen.
And if I remember correctly, didn't he beat James Blake in the semis?
Blake in the semis, and then Marty Fish in the final. So Marty Fish
really,
had a taste of Olympic success, but he's skipping it this year.
That I didn't remember. But I know Isner wants to play with Serena mixed doubles, which would also be a pretty good chance for some American medals in London. You know, the other normally there are some other competitors even on the French. I don't even know what we're looking at. Robin Soderling is always a threat, but he's been out for the better part of a year. Song is playing on his home country, although he's never been overwhelmingly successful in the French. He doesn't particularly fit his game. Andy Murray is still the poor fourth sister. Is there a player you can even see making? I mean, obviously you always have these Spanish. You've had these Spanish players, these South American players in the past, who've kind of come out of nowhere to make runs. Are the top three so dominant at this point that you can't even really think about it in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. The last time somebody didn't win, somebody outside of the top three won a slam was when Juan Martín Del Potro won the U.S. Open in 2009. And then before that, it was 2005. So, you know, that's a good 32 tournaments or whatever that where 30 have been won by three guys. So it's no exaggeration to say they're the men to beat. I mean, if you're going to look for a kind of dark horse semifinalist, you probably want to look to whoever is drawn in Murray's quarter. Murray hasn't been playing well in the past couple months. He is struggling with some back issues. And so if David Ferrer gets really lucky and draws Murray's quarter, he would be as close to a lock on clay as you would think there is, given his results. But at the same time, he's never really made noise at the French either. So, you know, Murray's quarter is going to be the toss-up. And Tsonga, I think, is capable of a run maybe that far, although, like you said, he doesn't like clay, and he recently told the press that no French player has any chance of winning. So that doesn't really, you know, sound too good for the French fans. Maybe Juan Martín Del Potro, he's been playing well as well. Thomas Berdych. You know, when your dark horses are other guys in the top 10, that's when you know it's a really stacked field.
Yeah. I'll switching over to the women's side. For the last couple of years, we've been dealing with really it's just been, I don't want to say a sea of mediocrity, but I don't think it's that far.
Oh, I think that's pretty accurate.
You know, Lee Na is a defending champion. Oh, she had a great run last year, but she hasn't had, I don't believe she's been particularly great the last year or so. Although I think she's been solid this year, but I think
she just made the Roma final.
You still have Serena, maybe healthy, may not be healthy. Who knows? You know, Azarenka has been fantastic. Has been very solid. Of course, she's now the number one player in the world, the Australian champion. But she's not a clay player. So, what do you see coming at? I mean, the only other names that really come up is Sam Stosur or Maria Sharapova, who's I give credit to because she could have retired years ago, but she just loves to play and loves to compete. What do you see coming out? What do you see on the women's side?
Well, believe it or not, Serena Williams so far this year is undefeated on clay. And even though she hasn't won all the tournaments she's entered, it's because she's withdrawn, questionably, in my opinion, before she's had to play additional matches. So, for example, in Rome, she was cruising through until she reached the semifinals, where she was slated to play Lee Na and withdrew, supposedly with some back trouble, but I think she just had decided she played enough tennis before the French. And I think right now she has to be the favorite. She's played virtually every serious competitor in the run-up to the French that she could face. Thrashed Sharapova and Victoria Azarenka at the Madrid tournament. I mean, those matches weren't even close, and Maria hasn't beaten Serena in years.
Well, let's say if we're going to look for a sleeper in the women's side, give us a person that's up and coming that we should be looking at.
Well, she kind of made a name for herself last year, but Petra Kvitova is the number four player in the world right now, last year's Wimbledon champion. If she comes into the tournament healthy, she definitely has a shot. A lot of the women that's mentioned also could make some noise. Aga Radwanska is the world number three and kind of plays a clever cat-and-mouse kind of tennis, but doesn't have the power really to hit through the ball enough on clay to end points. Angelique Kerber, I think, is maybe the best no-name player kind of going right now. She's a younger German player who's strung together a lot of solid results over the past year or so and has, I think, finally cracked the top 10 at number 10. She's beaten a lot of great players this year. I would look for her.
Now, let me ask you something for those listeners of ours that are uneducated. Why is clay, first of all, so much harder than every other surface, or so it seems like, and why is it a difference between the tournaments? Why is it so specialized for clay? You keep referring to playing on clay as opposed to when they go to Wimbledon playing on grass or playing on hard court, either in Australia or in the U.S. So perhaps you can give me a little bit of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Hard court, obviously, is just concrete. You know the bounce is going to be the same every single time. No real questions. Grass is very slick. The ball stays lower and kind of slides on it because it's a smooth, natural surface. Clay is it's like a composite of stone surfaces covered in crushed brick. So it the ball catches it, and it really accentuates topspin, and it slows the points down a lot. So it kind of presents this duality of opportunity, I guess, because if you're a really fast player, your goal is to keep points going as long as you can and run them down, because since the ball it gets caught in the dirt, essentially, it gives you that much more time to run it down. But then again, if you don't have a lot of power, like Agnieszka Radwańska or somebody like Andy Murray, for example, on the men's side, and you can't end points, basically you end up spinning your wheels and kind of running yourself into the ground while the other opponent punishes you. So, but then, of course, you look at Rafael Nadal, and his movement is insane. He moves better on clay because of the way you can slide on that brick, and then pair that with the obscene amounts of topspin he can put on the ball and the fact that he's a lefty. It just kind of has confounded the whole tour for going on 8 years now. It's almost like he was born on this stuff. And so that's why it's so different. And it's funny that you say it's more difficult to win on. I think that's justifiably so, an American perspective on the surface, in that we've always been power players, hit hard, go to the net, you know, McEnroe or Andy Roddick or Pete Sampras. But that extra little bit of time that clay gives you, it blunts the power of the serve and the ground strokes, so that all these, you know, lesser players on other surfaces have just that extra little bit of time to get to the ball and hit the passing shot or return the serve.
So is that what makes an Andre Agassi a guy that won on both hard court and, I mean, he won on all the surfaces? Does that make his accomplishments that much bigger because he's won on every surface?
Absolutely. He's only one of now 7 men, including Federer and Nadal, to have won all 4 slams in their careers, something Pete Sampras actually never did. So while Sampras had 14 slams and Agassi only 8, you know, I bump Agassi up a little bit in my rankings just because of the way he did what clearly so few other players in the entire history of the game have been able to do, and that's translate his game onto all types of surfaces, not just hard courts, or, you know, Pete Sampras was amazing on grass. Agassi found a way to do it everywhere, and that's pretty special.
Well, before we have you go, because the show is going to go off in a few minutes, I wanted to ask, number one, are there any American women? Obviously, it has been outside of the Williams sisters, it's been a pretty tough run for the American women over the last decade. You know, a Maddox Sands, the one who made the running U.S. Open a few years ago, I forget her name, the 16-year-old.
Or she can't even win matches these days. She can't even win set games. It's terrible.
I mean, is there anything really to look forward to in American women's tennis once the Williams sisters, I mean, and even Venus has kind of fallen a bit by the wayside due in part to her injuries over the last few years. Is there anything on the horizon?
I think it's tougher to determine who's going to be a great female player now versus maybe even 10 years ago. We don't really see that many teenage phenoms anymore, and it takes more time. I think the game has become more physical, and so, you know, it's become almost on par with the men's game in the sense that you don't really kick in as a great player until you develop fully, you know, and maybe once you're into your early 20s. But there are a couple teenage prospects that look good. Sloane Stephens has a good game. She's, I think, 19 years old and has had some decent wins and had a nice run at the U.S. Open last year. Christina Cale has won some tight matches.
Sean?
Could you also make the claim that women's tennis has kind of learned from the struggles of, like, a Jennifer Capriati or that age generation, where maybe it was too much too soon? So perhaps they are developing players a little bit more rather than playing them at such a young age.
It's definitely a case-by-case situation. After Capriati, her famous struggles, they kind of enacted a rule that limited the number of tournaments you could enter at certain ages. But then in 1997, Martina Hingis won 3 Grand Slams when she was 16. So, you know, obviously she found a way to navigate the tour at such a young age. Do I think that there is a one-size-fits-all kind of solution? Not necessarily. But I think it's just more a sense of physically, you know, the game, it's harder on the body, both men and women. If you don't serve well enough or keep up with ground strokes, you don't really have a chance. And so I think that's why we don't see the Steffi Graf and Tracy Austin's and Monica Seles's anymore. People who are competitive at that young of an age, they just can't keep up, I think.
All right. Well, before we let you go, let's get the semifinal and final predictions for on both sides, starting with the women.
With the women, you know, I think Radwanska and Azarenka should make the semis if their draws fall right. Serena absolutely, she's not going to be a top four seed, so she could take one of those two out. It kind of depends on how the draw falls, but I could see those three, and then maybe Sharapova even, who's had a great clay season. But from there, I'd say Serena's got to be the lock to win. She would probably own all of those players pretty easily on clay. On the men's side, I'm going to say definitely the top three. With Federer at three, it's really tough for him to get through to a final. The fourth is a wild card because I don't think Murray will make it out of that quadrant. I'd look for Burdic or Del Potro or Ferrer would be my other three choices if one of them falls there. But getting back on the red stuff, Nadal looks right at home. I think he's going to win his seventh.
Ryan Krenigan, tennis analyst, backsportspage.com. Thanks a lot for coming on, Ryan.
Thanks, guys.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
So, see, we do a variety of sports at Seth and Sean, or Seth and the Gimp, or whatever we're going by today.
Well, basically, it was Sean and the person that doesn't know anything about tennis. I'm sorry, Seth and the person that doesn't know anything about tennis. I know when to acquiesce to the more informed, and tennis is not one of my strong points, so Seth took that away, and we thank all of our guests. We'd like to give them a gift, but at this point, we don't have a sponsor, so we can't do that. But we're looking into that. So as soon as Seth talks to Randy Zelia and gets us some sponsors, we'll be giving gifts to our guests. Wow, that look that came in the room was very, I don't even know how to describe it. But if you'd like to sponsor the show, please give us a call, 760-283-0846. You're looking for both sponsors and now callers. So if you'd like to come in, call on in. But, I mean, it's always nice to talk about a sport that we generally don't talk about. I mean, there's actually another sport that we don't talk about at all that went on this past weekend, the Preakness, and I'll Have Another is going for the Triple Crown. Seth, did you get to watch the race?
I saw it on replay. I was watching the Champions League final. But it was an incredible comeback. Jody Meister was up the entire race, and then, and I am certainly not a horse racing expert, although I did sleep at a Holiday Inn last night. And he made a great run down the stretch and beat him by a nose. And people are still a little bit suspicious because there's been, I believe, since affirmed in 1978. There's been 11 horses who have won the first two and have been unable to win the Belmont being the longest at a mile and a half. Bodie Meister is not going to be there.
Bodie Miller may be betting on him.
He may be. But I believe that there are some horses who did not compete in the Preakness that will be at the Belmont and that will be well rested. And you know what? I'm not going to say I'm a huge fan, but it's one of those things you do watch. It does make you want to watch that third race when there is someone trying to do something that hasn't been done in 30 years. And
30 years, man, for the CPA in you, that math is awfully short.
40 years, 38 years, whatever, 35 years. I was just kind of rounding, but thank you for reminding me of that fact. It was a great race to watch. And I get, all credit to Mike O'Neill and Mario, I forget his last name off the top of my head, the jockey when you're coming back from 6, 7, 8, places
length.
Back.
Length.
Length. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty incredible, especially just going then going around the outside and going in and catching him at the end. So we got about 4 minutes and change left, so I will go first with my closing. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Chelsea. Chelsea, a team, because it was the most impressive accomplishment in sports this weekend. When you have a team, and I compared them on, with some people to the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1955, Chelsea, a team led by veterans, older players, pretty much in a lot of ways past their prime, led by four guys who've been there for at least 10 years, Didier Drogba, Frank Lampard, Pierre Cech, the goalie, and John Terry, the captain and defenseman who actually wasn't able to play due to a red card in the semifinal against Barcelona. They were able to go to Germany and beat Bayern Munich in penalty kicks, an incredible accomplishment, considering they were outshot 35-9, out corner kicked 20-1, and the one corner kick that they got was they actually scored on a Didier Drogba header in the 88th minute to tie the game. Arjen Robben missed a penalty kick that would have won in overtime. In overtime, they go to a 30-minute overtime, and then you have the penalty kicks, and they were able to come back and win. Drogba is going to now leave Chelsea because he scored the game-winning goal, and there's no reason really for him to stay because it's kind of hitting the penultimate. But I compare it to the Brooklyn Dodgers in 55 because their best years were in the earlier years, to 49, 50, 51, 52, when they lost to the Yankees in the finals. This team was better in 06 and 07 and 09 when they lost to Man U in a heartbreaking Champions League final. And they were able to will it out under an interim coach. And I just wanted to give them credit because I think it's an incredible accomplishment. And, you know, for a team that finished sixth in their league this year, to win the most valuable, pretty much the most valuable club championship in soccer, props to Chelsea. And that's all I got for today, so I will head it over to the GIMP to close it.
All right, well, the GIMP has some thanks to go around to all my friends that have chipped in this past week to help me in my gippiness, including my co-host who brought over some ice for my knee, so thank you very much. To my mother, who's done a fantastic job of being a mom this week and helping me out, and to all, my friend Jamie, who sent me some nice fruit. Everybody, thank you very much. But for my parting shot, you know, I brought this up on our Facebook page, which is Seth and Sean Sports, and please check us out on Facebook or on Twitter. But sometimes athletes are role models, and athletes are heroes to a lot of people. But Marvel Comics did a fantastic thing for a little boy, a four-year-old boy, Anthony Smith, this week, which I could not believe. Anthony Smith was born without a right ear. He's 80% deaf in his left ear. He wears a hearing aid. And one day he woke up and said, I didn't want to put on my hearing aid because superheroes don't wear hearing aids. So what did his mother do? Like all good moms, she tried to find a way. She contacted Marvel superheroes and asked them for, is there any superhero that wears hearing aids? And actually Hawkeye, from the Avengers, does wear a hearing aid in the comic books. He lost 80% of his hearing, and he wears hearing aids. And not only that, they later sent Anthony a drawing of a new superhero called Blue Ear. And the character is named after Anthony's hearing aid, which he and his mother have always called Blue Ear. So props, big-time props to Marvel Comics, because, man, it's hard enough when you have a handicap. It's hard enough. I mean, I'm gimping around. I don't put myself anywhere near this kid as far as what he has to go through on a daily basis. I can only imagine what he and millions of other people that have handicaps go through every day. So anything that Marvel or any of us can do to help a handicapped person, I would highly suggest going out of your way and helping who you can, because you know what? They have it tough. We have it tough. Everybody has a tough life. Somebody always has it tougher than you. For Seth Kamens, this is Sean Palmer. We had a great show. We talked a lot about the French Open, which I know absolutely nothing about. But since I will be on my butt for the next 2 weeks, I'll be watching a lot of. And we'll check you out next week. We'll talk a little bit more about the NBA. Maybe we'll touch a little bit about baseball. Thanks to all the supporters around the globe.
And for Seth Kamens, this is Sean Palmer, and we'll check in next week. Thanks again. See ya.